Is there really such a thing as distance, and is the globe really spheroid? Question. What is the meaning of right this and right that? Does that mean one should eat only with the right hand? That last question is quite sensible, you know. You might think that some sort of nut or cook sent it in, but if you think about it seriously, there is a lot of sense to it. What is the meaning of right this and right that? Well, we know all about doing things the right way and avoiding wrong. We know it is right to do good instead of to do wrong. But do you know that our hands have polarity? One hand is positive and one hand is negative. If you read back a few paragraphs to where we dealt with palms, you will see that the left hand deals with the abstract, that is, things before we came to this earth, how we planned things, whereas the right hand is the practical hand, the hand which says how far we have achieved our objectives. In the same way, some of the Arabs of a few years ago had a very definite ruling about hands. The left hand was known as the dirty hand, and that hand could be used only for dirty tasks such as dealing with certain aspects of one's toilet, but the right hand was the clean hand, and one could only use the right hand when dealing with food. All foodstuff was touched with the right hand, although one could pick up a cup or a glass with the left hand. It would be quite interesting to investigate the matter further and see how much difference it made to one's digestion when one touched food with the right hand only, and then, perhaps a month later, touch food with the left hand only. The right hand is the correct hand for holding a dagger or sword, or shaking hands with a person. In the old days, people used to carry a knife or dagger in the right hand as a means of warding off attackers, so when they met a friend they would extend the right hand to show that they had no knife hidden, to show that they came in friendship. And so we had the start of the custom of shaking hands. Shake a person's hand and you can see that he is not holding a knife against his palm with his thumb, and if he has any weapons concealed in his sleeve, well, shake them out. From the same source there is another question. It is, how does the silver cord connect the physical, and the over-self, and the astral at the same time? The silver cord, like everything else, is a vibration, which means that it is also a source of energy. The cord does not necessarily have to go to just one other object, that is, it is not limited to connecting body and soul together. Extensions can be taken from it in just the same way as you can have extensions taken from your telephone. If you have a telephone in your living room, then it's no great difficulty to have an extension to your bedroom. It is ordinary common sense to realize that the overself is the source of each person's energy, the source of each person's being, and the over-self, you can say, has each human on a leash. So just as you can have a dog on a leash, or you can have 10 dogs all on leashes, so you can have an over-self connected to an astral and to a physical body. There is really nothing to answer in that question except to say that if you have a dog, let us say a big dog, at the end of a leash, it is quite easy to connect a small dog to the leash of the big dog, and that would correspond to the over-self, the astral, and the physical. Through writing books I have come into contact with some perfectly horrible people, some real cooks who might well be classed as mental home dropouts. They are in the great minority, but I have also come into contact with some remarkably nice people. For example, there are two very nice ladies in British Columbia, Miss and Mrs. Newman. They are truly trying to make a success of life, and I consider that they are achieving success. They have sent some questions, and here in this chapter 1 I'm going to reply to just one of the questions for the special reason that it fits in so well. So here is an answer to a specific question from Miss and Mrs. Newman. The question is, will you please explain homosexuality in much the same way as you explained alcoholics in Beyond the Tenth? Our overself, as I have explained, is getting experience on Earth. The overself itself is too big, too powerful and too high vibrating to come to Earth, and so it has to employ those lumps of protoplasm which we in our ignorance think is the highest form of existence anywhere. We humans are just hunks of meat supported on a bony framework and propelled around by grace of the overself, but inevitably hitch-ups occur. Sometimes a car manufacturer says to himself, in effect, of course, oh, glory be, I've connected the brakes back before frontways on such and such a car. Let's call it back. So notices go out to car owners and the cars have to be recalled to the factory for certain things to be put right. In the hurly-burly of getting from the astral world to that world we call Earth, mix-ups occur. Being born is a traumatic experience, it's a most violent affair, and a very delicate mechanism can easily become deranged. For example, a baby is about to be born and throughout the pregnancy the mother has been rather careless about what she was eating and what she was doing, so the baby has not received what one might term a balanced chemical input. The baby may be short of a chemical and so development of certain glands may have been halted. Let us say the baby was going to come as a girl, but through lack of certain chemicals, the baby is actually born a boy with the inclinations of a girl. The parents might realize that they've got a sissified little wretch and put it down to overindulgence or something. They may try to beat some sense into him one end or the other to make him more manly, but it doesn't work. If the glands are wrong, never mind what sort of attachments are stuck on in front, the boy is still a girl in a boy's body. At puberty the boy may not develop satisfactorily, or again, he may to all outward appearances. At school he may well appear to be one of the limp-wristed fraternity, but the poor fellow can't help that. When he reaches man's estate he finds he cannot do the things that come naturally, instead he runs after boys, men. Of course he does because all his desires are the desires of a woman. The psyche itself is female, but through an unfortunate set of circumstances the female has been supplied with male equipment. It might not be much use but it's still there. The male then becomes what used to be called a pansy and has homosexual tendencies. The more the psyche is female, the stronger will be the homosexual tendencies. If a woman has a male psyche, then she will not be interested in men but will be interested in women, because her psyche, which is closer to the over-self than is the physical body, is relaying confusing messages to the over-self and the over-self sends back a sort of command, get busy, do your stuff. The poor wretched male psyche is obviously repelled by the thought of doing his stuff with a man, and so all the interest is cantered on a female. So you get the spectacle of a female making love to a female and that's what we call a lesbian because of a certain island off Greece where that used to be the done thing. It is quite useless to condemn homosexuals, they are not villains, instead they should be classed as sick people, people who have glandular troubles, and if medicine and doctors had the brains they were born with then they would do something about that glandular defect. After my own experiences of late I am even more convinced that Western doctors are a crummy lot of cooks just out to make a fast buck. My own experiences have been unmentionably and adjectivally deplorable, however we are not discussing me now, we are discussing homosexuals. If a lesbian, woman, or a homosexual, male, can find a sympathetic doctor, then glandular extracts can be given which certainly improve a condition a lot and make life bearable, but unfortunately nowadays with the present breed of doctor who seems to be out to make money only, well, you have to search a long way to get a good doctor. But it is useless to condemn a homosexual, it is not his fault or her fault. They are very, very unhappy people because they are confused, they don't know what has happened to them, they know that people are sneering at them. And they can't help what is, after all, the strongest impulse known to man or woman, the reproduction impulse. Head shrinkers alias psychologists are not much help, really because they take years to do what the average person would do in a few days. If it is clearly explained to the homosexuals that they have a glandular imbalance, then they can usually adjust. Anyhow, the laws are being amended to cater for such cases instead of subjecting them to such fierce persecution and imprisonment for what is truly an illness. There are various ways of helping such people. The first is deep sympathy with the sufferer should explain precisely what has happened. The second is the same as the first but with the addition that the victim should be given some medicament which suppresses the sexual urge, the sexual drive. The third, well, again, matters should be explained, and a qualified doctor can give hormone or testosterone injections which can definitely help the body in the matter of sexual adjustment. The vital thing is that one should never, never condemn a homosexual, it's not his fault, he is being penalized for something he hasn't done, He is being penalized for some fault of nature. Perhaps his mother hid the wrong sort of food. Perhaps the mother and the child were chemically incompatible. However, whichever way you look at it, homosexuals can only be helped by true understanding and sympathy, and possibly with the judicious administration of drugs. I see here a question which actually we have already answered. Perhaps I had better answer it again. The question is, how did the misconception occur that occultists cannot charge for their services? The answer is not far to seek. In the Far East, most people are desperately poor. They do not have televisions and cars and private aircraft and split-level homes. Sometimes they just have food and a few clothes. Sometimes people of the Far East do not see money during the whole of their lifetime. Instead, they make their purchases by barter. They exchange produce, eggs and all that, or even labor, for the things they want. So if a peasant wants the services of an occultist, the peasant will not think of giving money to the occultist because he doesn't have any, so instead he will provide the occultist with food, grain for example, or fruit, and again, if he doesn't have any eggs or grain or fruit to spare, then he will do work for the occultist, mend his robes for example, carve a new bowl. If he had accommodation, then the peasant will clean his accommodation. It may be a cave and the hillside, and in that case the person who has used the occultist's service will clean the cave so many times, will sweep up the old grass and strew the floor with fresh grass. He will provide firewood and will do all necessary work. It's still payment, though, isn't it? If he gives food, if he gives labor, it's still payment. But actually the warning against payment was a different matter altogether, because the warning is against unscrupulous Westerners who advertise services they cannot really perform, and who are just out to make unreasonable charges. Some of the advertisements I have seen are truly too fantastic to be believed. It strikes me as most hilarious to think of a fellow packing his briefcase and perhaps an overnight case and dashing off into the astral to read somebody's Akashic record. Always, of course, for a high fee. Such things are impossible. They are quite impossible, because there is a very strict occult law to the effect that no person can see the Akashic record of another person who is alive. If you want to know what happened 500 years ago, then that is a different matter, that is history, and you can consult the Akashic record in that case, just as you can go to film libraries and pick out historical films. But just as many things are classified nowadays, you cannot report the speed of a certain plane, nor you cannot say how fast a certain shell goes. Well, in much the same way you just cannot see or discuss the AKA Akashic record of a living person. After all, the spirit world, you know, doesn't exist solely for some of these cranky advertisers. Think of that when you read some of the advertisements, and have a laugh with me, will you? Chapter 7, Injure Others and You Injure Yourself. The day had been very pleasant, a clear blue sky and a warmer temperature than had been during the past few weeks. There were signs that the winter had ended and that spring was really thinking about peeping around the corner of the calendar and bringing warmth and sunshine and new life to those jaded and defeated by the frigid winters of Canada. In the valleys, snow was still thick and would remain so for perhaps a few weeks more. But in the higher ground exposed to the warming rays of the sun, the snows were fast melting and trickling rivulets came rushing down to swell the St. John River. The day had seen many birds flying by, signs that spring was coming, birds returning to their old haunts. A whole covey of ducks went by, soon after a huge black-back seagull had come sweeping in from the sea to land on the roof and to peer about and utter raucous cries. The evening had turned chilly. There was a hint of snow in the air. Suddenly, unexpectedly, there came the drumming of hailstones beating rapidly upon the windows, bouncing off the balconies, and, for a few moments, carpeting the road with a white icy sheen. The old man thought, "Oh, poor Mr. Robicord, he'll have to get busy again in the morning." During the day, Mr. Robicord had been very busy sweeping aside puddles of melting snow, brushing away gravel thrown down by city trucks in an attempt to provide traction for motor traffic. But now the hail had come driving fresh gravel into the front of the building and adding to the work of an already much overworked man. The evening sped by and lights in the city went out one by one. In the hospital the lights were ever on, always ready for emergencies, always ready by day and by night. The old man turned his head and looked out of the window. Over the balcony, down in the harbor there was still activity. The Russian ship loading grain for Russia was still a blaze of light. There was the clank of machinery and the hissing of high-pressure steam. Closer there was the terrible blare, and blare, and blare again as one of the Canadian National Infernal diesel engines clattered along the rails over the level crossing, hooting and blaring as if the world had gone mad. "I wonder that no one has told the engineer that there are signal lights on the crossing," thought the old man, "because it does seem insane how in Canada locomotives go along to the constant blare of sirens and the incessant clanging of bells. It's something like a gang of very small children playing with toys in the noisiest way possible. Canada, even more than the USA, should be known as the land of noise and bustle." The old man lifted his gaze again beyond the level crossing and the endless procession of freight cars obstructing the road. In the harbor, tugs were coming to a Liberian ship which had just recently unloaded 7,000 tons of nickel ore. Earlier the ship had been arrested for non-payment of dues in the USA. It had steamed away from a Pacific coast port apparently without the little formality of paying harbor dues, but the telephone was much faster than a ship and telephone messages had raced all across from the Pacific coast of the USA to the east coast of Canada, and earlier in the day police officials had marched aboard the ship and served an arrest order to the captain. Frantic work had resulted in a bond being posted and now the ship was free to move, so tugs were coming to tow her out sternwards, tow her out backwards into the deep water channel and then, with her pointing in the right direction, off she would steam possibly for Australia. The pilot was already aboard, the pilot boat was going out beyond the buoys waiting for the ship which would then slow and the pilot boat would sidle along and take off the pilot, and then the ship would be free to move away on her own. The ship went out silently, no hooting, no clanking, no hissing of steam. The ship stole away as if she were ashamed of being arrested through the perfidy and bad faith of mankind, mankind as exemplified by those who should have paid the bills incurred for their service. All over the city the sleeping people were leaving their physical bodies and going up into the astral worlds, their silver cords were stretched out like skins of silk, self-illuminated, shiny, twitching and jerking. The old man smiled to himself because from one room came the soft snores of Buttercup. "She'd never believe what a racket she is making," thought the old man. Suddenly her astral form appeared through a wall and off she shot, straight up and then away in the direction of the USA. With her astral out of her body the snores increased. From another room Rab was doing a bit of snoring too. She had gone off earlier to an astral cat land where she would be met by some truly beloved little people, Miss Kuei, Mrs. Fifi Grey Whiskers, Miss Cindy, Long Tom, and Lord Farad, and others. Rab had the benefit that she was aware of when she was going to the land of the astral cats, but probably Rab was not aware of how stertorous her snores would be. Little girl cat Cleopatra was sleeping away as well beside Rab. She too was off to the land of the astral cats, but fat cat Tadakins was on duty. She would be on duty until 4 o'clock in the morning, and fat cat Tadakins was resting on the shelf just above the radiator where she got all the warmth, all the beautifully heated rising air. One arm was dangling over, the other was supporting her chin. Her hind quarters were facing one way and her head quarters were facing another way, a position that only a cat could adopt. Far out in the bay of Fundy a fishing boat suddenly flashed its searchlight. It wavered around for a moment and then, as suddenly, was extinguished and there was no trace that a little fishing vessel was anywhere about. Yet all over the bay there were fishing vessels with their lines out and with their nets, hoping to get fish in that were not contaminated by the mercury in the water flowing from the USA, from some big industrial plant in the USA which had discharged much poisonous effluvia into the streams passing by their boundaries. And yet there was a fresh source of poison because an oil tanker had broken up and sunk beneath the waves off the coast of Nova Scotia, and oil and poisoned birds and fish were being swept shorewards all the time. So the fishermen of New Brunswick were out about their business rather gloomily, knowing that their livelihood was at stake because of the criminal manner in which man polluted the sources of nature. The sky had a few clouds scudding across, there seemed to be quite a wind coming up. The three flags away on the hill were flapping madly and the halyards were slapping against the masts as if in unison with the waving of the flags. Over the hill beyond Misbeck the full moon suddenly sailed with amazing rapidity straight up into a clear patch of sky, casting a pale brilliance over the whole scene, dimming the street lights, dimming the lights along the new bridge over the St. John River, and as the moon rose the shaft of silver light sped rippling along the sea all the way from Misbeck Point to the harbour, brilliant fingers touching a fishing vessel here, lighting a buoy there, silvering a strip of land and breaking up in ripples as it encountered the wake of a speeding tug. The old man turned suddenly and a sharp, daring, wrenching pain gripped him inside, a pain that left him gasping and almost retching with the sudden agony of it. Pain, his constant companion for a long time past, pain which was becoming even more frequent and even more intense. Pain which pointed with inexorable fingers at the calendar showing how the journey through life was progressing, showing how soon it must end. On the shelf above the radiator Fat Cat Tadakin stood up, peered intently at the old man, muttered to herself, and went trotting into where Rab was still asleep. Soon the silver cord attached between Rab's astral and physical quivered and started to reel in, it reeled in with increasing rapidity until the astral body came as well. Seconds after Rab came in to see what could be done for the old man, but what could be done? The old man had been in a state of permanent amazement since having medical treatment in Canada. In his ignorance he had thought that the first duty of a doctor was the relief of suffering, that is what he had been taught. He had been taught that first of all you relieve the suffering, then you try to cure what caused it. But now, well, he saw the other side of the story. Not as the doctor but as the patient. The old man had had much pain and he and Rab had asked the doctors for some pain-relieving tablets, or anything. First they had been told, no, we do not want to give it yet, it might disguise the symptoms. But in the meantime the old man still had his pain, still had his suffering. In the meantime the old man had been taken to hospital as a desperate emergency. And a compassionate nurse at the first hospital had done what the doctors did not seem able to do. Then came the second emergency and another hospital, and the verdict that nothing could be done. So, knowing that nothing could be done to cure, the old man and Rab and Buttercup just could not understand why it was that nothing could be done to relieve suffering, to ease the pain, to give rest for, to ask yet again, is not the doctor's first task the relief of suffering? And if he cannot cure the cause, then surely he can give relief while there is still life. So Rab looked around helplessly, what was there that she could do? There wasn't anything, she had no drugs, nothing. So once again she just had to sit and watch and give nothing else except sympathy and understanding. Soon there came Cleopatra who did the feline equivalent of handsprings in the hope of distracting attention from pain, in the hope of providing some light relief. And Cleopatra and Tadakins both purred away to show how they understood how bad all this suffering was. Two little people who to the average man or woman in the street would appear to be just two very, very beautiful little animals, but to those who know them these two little people are people apart, intelligent, highly civilized and entirely sympathetic and understanding. And so the old man lying in his bed of pain still wondered why the local medical fraternity did not seem to have heard of pain relievers, or, if they had, why did they not use them, why did they not use such methods of giving relief to one who truly was in considerable distress. Now the sky darkened. The moon was extinguished by black lowering clouds. A sudden haze came over the far sea and sped rapidly landwards. The first pattering drops of rain hit the window panes and a blast of air shook the building. Soon the storm burst in all its fury, the howling, shrieking wind and torrents of rain interspersed with hail. Down it came drowning out all memory of the pleasant day, hiding the harbor under a veil of rain. Lights in the streets showed up as a ghostly greenish blue as the sodium lamps vainly strove to penetrate the water fog and the beating rain. The drumming of the rain was monotonous, the shrieking of the wind howling around the corners of the building, pushing against the windows, Making the doors rattle, it reminded the old man of how things seemed to be inside him. The night seemed endless, it seemed that every minute was an hour, and every hour was a day. Rab, at the old man's request, went back to bed. Cleo stayed for a time, when she too went back to bed. Tadakins resumed her post on the shelf until 4 o'clock in the dark and gloomy morning. At 4 o'clock Ms. Cleopatra came back into the room and jumped up by Taddy. Briefly they touched noses and Taddy jumped off, leaving Miss Cleopatra to settle down into almost the same position that Taddy had adopted. Outside the first traffic was beginning to move, early workers going to the docks. Down below a man started his car, perhaps he was going to the dry dock to see what was happening. A lonely tug hooted away as if lost in the rain and darkness. There was no sign of the lighthouse, the rain completely obscured its rays, but faintly could be heard the mournful lowing of the foghorn. The hours dragged on. At last dim grey light appeared over the Misbeck Hills, a dim grey light which did little to dispel the gloom, for it just showed a thoroughly unpleasant day, everything saturated with water. Water teeming from the rooftops, water streaming down the roadways, and suddenly squalls obliterating the sight of the bridge and the harbour. More hours passed on, and more people began to stir. Rab came back, shortly after Buttercup came. Another day had started. The harbour looked almost empty. A blue star freighter was just turning into the stream ready to go out. She too was anxious to leave us. The Russian ship was still there with a faint plume of steam coming from its exhaust, and down on the DOT wharf men were boarding one of the red-hulled ships that went out to take supplies to the lighthouse keepers and provide service to the light boys and the sound boys. In the middle of the harbour a solitary tug was motionless, a figure at the stern seemed to be hauling in on a fishing line. Perhaps the tugmen were trying to catch their breakfast. The inevitable, incessant mail came pouring in. On this day, with the old man feeling like something the cat brought in, 78 letters came, nearly all of them from people who wanted something, nearly all of them without the elementary courtesy of a reply stamp. One woman wrote so gushingly, "Oh, Dr. Rampa, I have been told that you are going to die and I thought I must get your help before it was too late for me. Will you do this for me? You must do this for me before you die." People wrote in and wrote in, the old man did his best to answer reasonable questions. Buttercup worked hard and accurately typing the letters, which the old man was now no longer able to do, but there was no let up from people. So many of them, no sooner had they received a reply than they sent back a whole shoal of questions before it was too late. One lady in Toronto sent 7 letters all by one delivery. Apparently she wrote a letter of several pages and then when she got it all ready and posted she thought of other things she wanted to know, and so on, until 7 letters had arrived. The old man had many strange experiences with letters. One woman in Ontario wrote really inflammatory letters and managed to get hold of the old man's address. She got in touch with the police and said it was desperately necessary to contact Dr. Rampa. It was a matter of life and death. And so our good-natured, well-intentioned local police sent a police car to where the old man lived, to where the old man was ill, and the policeman had a very stern order. You must phone this number immediately, it's a matter of life and death. The same woman sent special delivery letters, telegrams, everything. And at last the old man couldn't stick it any longer. At last was caused by a letter from the woman saying that unless the old man would be her friend she would commit suicide, and she enclosed 3 pages with just the same thing repeated, die, name, die, name, die, name. The old man could take no more, so he got in touch with the police in the district in which she lived, and the police went along to see her about these letters of an amatory nature. Now from that quarter at least, there has been peace. It is understood, though, that the poor unfortunate policeman who had to call upon her returned to the station considerably shaken by the experience. When the old man was at Habitat he was in bed one night quite seriously ill. At round about midnight there came a thunderous knocking at the door. Rab hurried from her room and the old man managed to get out of bed and into the wheelchair, and to grasp something in case it was an unwanted intruder. but at the door were two French Canadian policemen, and in decidedly shaky English they demanded to see Dr. Ramper. One of the policemen was from the fraud squad, the other was a police driver.